Meeting of the Committee on Veterans Affairs, and welcome you here today. Like, first of all, to recognize our veterans and veterans here, would you stand and let us recognize you and thank you for your service. We are grateful, and we know we're sitting here today because of your sacrifice, and we thank you for that. Okay, today, first on our agenda, we're really pleased to have one of our County Veteran Service Officers from Washington County, Debbie Kincaid, and welcome.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Debbie Kincaid, and I am a County Veteran Service Officer in Washington County. I am also the Secretary for the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I've been listening to the committee testimonies, and I want to thank you for serving on this committee and for adopting as your mission the task of finding out what issues face Oregon veterans, what's working well, what's not, and what needs to be done to serve them better. We appreciate that. I know that a variety of representatives from federal, state, and county agencies have already spoken to you about these issues, and there are several. One significant issue is the access that veterans and their dependents have to information and to trained, competent representation in benefit claims processing. Obtaining benefits and services under federal regulation can be quite difficult. Eligibility is often unclear, and most often it's difficult to secure those benefits without the advocacy of a trained representative. While I have the utmost respect for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, it cannot complete its mission of serving this nation's veterans on its own. It needs the help of people in the field. And County Veteran Service Officers are those people in the field. County Veteran Service Officers have an acute knowledge of federal veterans' benefits. They act as the veterans' advocate in preparing claims, gathering evidence to support those claims, and in presenting applications for adjudication. And they act as an ongoing liaison between the veteran and his or her dependents and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to maintain that eligibility that is affected by a variety of changing factors. With that said, the reason I'm here today is to tell you about the Veterans Pilot Project, which demonstrated one very important way in which County Veterans Service Officers have an effect on veterans' quality of life, also their financial independence, and the potential to eliminate their dependence on public funds. In 2001, the Oregon Legislature directed the Seniors and People with Disabilities Group of the Department of Human Services to conduct a one-year pilot project as a cost reduction strategy. I brought along a copy of the budget note, which you have before you, and what it says is that the purpose of the project is to attempt to save Medicaid long-term care funds by assisting eligible veterans who are current Medicaid clients to attain federal veterans benefits that can be used to fund long-term care services. I participated in that joint pilot project between Washington County and Multnomah County. The project ran for 1 year, beginning December 1st, 2001, and ending November 30th, 2002. During that year, we targeted four ways at reducing costs to the state of Oregon and to the Medicaid long-term care system. The first way was to lower costs by identifying current clients who were potentially eligible for benefits but were not receiving those benefits. Let me give an example of that. If you have a veteran who's in a care facility, he's run out of his own resources and he can't afford the cost of his care, he goes on Medicaid for help in paying for that long-term care. Medicaid allows him to keep $122 a month as a personal incidental fund, enough to pay any health insurance premiums that he may have, and the remainder is paid to the care provider as his cost share for his services. If that veteran is also a wartime veteran, he may be eligible for a non-service-connected disability pension. That pension is based upon countable income. And when a veteran is utilizing all of his income to pay for his long-term care, generally his countable income is nearly zero. And in those cases, the veteran receives the maximum amount of veterans benefits that's provided under the law. Currently, that maximum is $1,412 for a single veteran and $1,674 for a married veteran. And what happens when they receive those funds is for every dollar they receive, that's $1 less that Medicaid has to pay for that individual's care, because their cost share increases when they receive their veterans benefits. The second way we targeted was to lower costs by helping current Medicaid clients who were already receiving VA benefits increase those benefits. What Medicaid case managers may not realize is that just because a veteran is receiving a benefit, he may not be receiving the maximum benefit under the law. And that is our role as County Veteran Service Officers, is to help those persons maximize their benefits, help them obtain everything that they're eligible for. So we would come across persons who, let's say, were receiving a disability compensation benefit, which is paid to the individual strictly based upon the level of that person's service-related disability, with no regard to income or long-term care expenses. So we found those people, identified that they were wartime veterans or widows of wartime veterans, and then helped those people get their maximized benefits, again, furthering the reduction of costs to the state long-term care system. The third way was a direct reimbursement to the general fund. Normally what happens when a veteran applies for benefits is that claim takes a long time. I would say 3 or 4 months is quick. It can typically take up to a year or longer for VA to process that claim. So there's most often a large retroactive benefit check that's due that veteran or that widow when their claim is approved. If when they receive that lump sum benefit check, and if they were covered by Medicaid services for that same period of time, Medicaid then has a claim to that money as a third-party resource, and they will ask that client, that veteran client, to reimburse the state general fund out of those VA monies. This, I believe, has a huge impact on the state's ability to afford Medicaid services for others, because as you know, Medicaid dollars are funded with 40 cents state funds and 60 cents federal funds makes up a Medicaid dollar. So for every dollar that the state receives back from that veteran, excuse me, they can purchase $2.50 worth of services. I have a spreadsheet that I have presented to you all that presents those numbers as far as what the savings were. And you'll see that the lump sum reimbursements were quite significant during the pilot year. The last way that we sought to lower cost to the state was in cost avoidance. During the pilot, we screened all individuals for potential benefits, not just the current clients, but those persons coming into the system looking for information and access to long-term care. We then diverted those who were potentially eligible onto federal veterans benefits, and many times were able to keep them off the Medicaid system entirely. Those savings weren't reflected necessarily in the pilot report. The state felt that it was difficult to quantify the savings for a person who did not enter the system initially. We were able to come to an agreement as far as what the actual out-of-pocket costs were for the different types of living facilities, such as adult foster home, assisted living, and nursing care, what the average cost is to the state per client, and they were able to give us some consideration for those expenses. The project was successful, although the report that submitted by the Seniors and People with Disabilities reflected a much smaller savings than we feel was actually realized, because it failed to take into consideration the claims pending at the time the pilot project ended. Again, it only lasted for 1 year, and claims before the Veterans Administration often take longer than a year. So persons that we assisted 8 months into the project didn't get a decision, didn't receive any money during that pilot year. During the first year, 79 clients served, received benefits during the first year and resulted in a reduction of cost to Medicaid. Total reduction in costs for the first year were $448,889. That was actually offset by the costs of the program, which were $300,000, resulting in a net savings of $148,889. By the end of the second year, however, 137 clients had received approval, and that further reduced Medicaid and state general fund expenditures. Total reduction in costs for the second year were $1,001,948. There were no expenses in the second year, i.e. salary costs, to offset the savings. Independently, we tracked the Washington County clients through the third year and the effect of their federal veteran benefits on Medicaid and state general fund expenditures. I've also given you that data. As of November 30th, 2004, in Washington County alone, 140 of the pilot project clients are reducing state expenditures by more than $69,000 per month and lowered state expenditures in the third year by more than $800,000. I'm hoping that the information about the pilot project leads you to the conclusion that funding county veteran service officers is a wise investment in state funds. The health care and the long-term care needs of our disabled population and our aging population are huge. Benefits and services are expensive. And veterans benefits can assist not only veterans, but their dependents as well in affording these continually rising costs. County veteran service officers help those persons get the benefits to help them afford their care. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. If I could answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Ms. Kincaid, first of all, I just want to compliment you on you're so professional.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you should just be commended for everything you do, and I'm sure you're a great benefit to the many veterans in Washington County.
And thank you.
And I just thank you for all you do for so many. Could you tell me how are you funded at the current time, your position?
Currently, my position is funded by county general fund dollars. Washington County receives approximately $10,100 annually from the state via the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And we currently receive some Medicaid match dollars. However, those Medicaid match dollars will be ending on June 30th of this year.
So your position, I'm sorry to have to ask you this, but for the benefit of a bill that we do have, that we're going to be considering shortly, what is an average salary for, or is it set across the state for county service veteran officers?
I don't believe that it's set across the state. The legislation that's out there right now in Senate Bill 10 and that the House is considering a similar package, I believe uses the cost that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs utilizes to pay its veterans benefits counselors as a standard, and I believe that amount is somewhere between $45,000 and $50,000 for a benefit package.
And that doesn't include benefits, right? That's salary.
No, that doesn't. That's salary and benefits.
That's both. Okay. That's both.
Yeah, they're pretty okay.
Okay, thank you. And how many clients do you serve totally in Washington County?
Our veteran population is approximately 39,000 veterans. Our current caseload right now is approximately 3,000 veterans. Not all of those need our attention every day, of course. I would say 1,500 of those 3,000 clients require our attention on a regular basis, and there are three service officers in Washington County right now handling those clientele.
And I'm just greatly concerned. I know we can't overnight, or I don't like the word can't. We're having a challenge overnight in changing the federal government's process. What do you think is the best thing we could do to expedite the turning over, turning around of these claims? It's seems to plague us. I mean, here are most deserving individuals in the world, and we treat them so poorly when it comes to, you know, we want them to respond immediately to a war situation, but we don't respond immediately to their needs for benefits. What can we do?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. VA has, the Department of Veterans Affairs has its hands tied as well, because there are significant regulations that govern veterans' benefits. It's my opinion that having good advocacy and good representation for veterans assists claims in going through the system quicker. We run into people every day who filed a claim once upon a time for benefits and were denied, or perhaps granted a benefit, but at a smaller level and amount that they were actually entitled to because they didn't know any better. They didn't know what evidence was needed to be successful in their benefit claim. County veteran service officers, national service officers with the veteran service organizations, the state service officers, those are people who know what the benefits are, know what types of evidence it takes to show eligibility, and can help the veteran and the veteran's dependents locate and present that information to the VA so that claims processing can occur more quickly.
So what should we do? Have a bus parade from the 48 contiguous states to Washington as soon as session's over and
that
ask
be a bad
them,
idea.
Are you listening? I mean, do you understand the plight you're putting these lives in?
Yeah.
You know, those who have risked their lives for, you know, America and the world.
I agree. There's too many people who have never gone to the Veterans Administration for assistance. You know, they served 50, 60 years ago sometimes, and unfortunately when it does come time for them to ask for some assistance, for some help that they deserve, it takes too long, and many times they pass away before those claims can be approved. Now, nobody likes for that to happen. The Veterans Administration doesn't like for that to happen, but the system is huge.
Do you work on a daily basis with TRICARE and TriWest?
Not so much with TRICARE, because that is a program that benefits military retirees and their dependents. And not all retirees, I would say a smaller portion of our clientele are actually military retired. The major portion of our clientele are disabled veterans and widows of veterans.
Are there any other questions? Representative Brett.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Your view of all the veterans' benefits and all the veterans' issues is great, and we've noticed that with all the county veterans service officers that we've seen, that their knowledge is expansive. How are you trained? What do you have a formal annual, and how do you keep abreast of the changing veterans' benefits, veterans' laws, and not so much, not even so much as what's written as law, but what's in between the lines, what's in between the laws? How do you keep abreast of all that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bruin, training is provided initially by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. They have a new County Veteran Service Officers Orientation Program. It has not been consistently given every year or immediately to every County Veteran Service Officer upon employment, but it is a helpful tool. We attend twice yearly trainings sponsored by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Those trainings are generally 20-hour trainings. We have also, as an association, the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association, have presented our own 2 or 3 day training during the year to our members. And we have also participated in federal Department of Veterans Affairs TRIP training. That is their program to educate service, not only their own people, but community partners such as ourselves into VA Department of Veterans Affairs laws and regulations. There are some outstanding tools out there, too, that many service officers have. The National Veterans Legal Services Project publishes a veterans benefits manual that is very comprehensive and has online capability to send you updates and whatnot as far as changes to the federal regulations as they occur.
And could you tell us what that's called again? Sounds like you ought to know about it.
The National Veterans Legal Services Project. They publish a veterans benefits manual.
Can I ask a follow-up for that? I would imagine this would be different among every, not only every county, every state for that matter, but is there an informal network? Do you connect well with the county veteran service officers in, say, you know, your county and Umatilla County, and is there a network to learn and expand from that as well, even if it's informal?
Not well enough.
Okay.
We, of course, are each employed by our respective counties.
Right.
So what our employers require and demand of us is different county to county. We are formed as a loose-knit association, and our goal is to increase our training and accreditation standards to provide the most professional service that we can. So that is one of our goals. But right now, other than email and things like that, it's not a closely connected association.
Okay.
So as far as training.
Right.
So a lot of counties sponsor their own training for people. So, for example, in my county, we are closely connected with the Medicaid office. We are part of that AAA Aging Services office. And so a lot of my training is cross-training with state programs and services so that knowledge helps me to better serve the veteran client or the widow client to maximize their benefits.
Ms. Kincaid, would you say that the veterans' benefits are far more comprehensive than Medicaid benefits?
I would say that the benefits are not as comprehensive, but more complicated and complex. My view of Medicaid, actually, I've referred to it before as kind of the full meal deal, that once you're on Medicaid, you get a full package of services. You get medical coverage. You get dental coverage. You get medical supplies. You get long-term care services if you qualify. And those services, that benefits package is coordinated by a case manager. In the realm of veterans' benefits, there is no single person to coordinate the veterans' benefits for any veteran or any widow. That person applies individually for each benefit that they may receive. There's nothing that motivates or prompts the VA to say, if you're getting this benefit, then you get this other benefit. They don't administer a package of services. And I should probably clarify that, because there are different portions of the VA. It is three parts in one. It is the Veterans Benefits Administration, which is all of the financial benefits, the compensation, the pension, the education. Then there's the Veterans Health Administration, which is their system of hospitals and clinics. And then there's the Veterans Cemetery Administration, and it runs its cemeteries, obviously. So a person can be treated by a VA hospital for 40 years and never ever deal with the veterans benefits side of the Veterans Administration, the money part. Conversely, a person could be getting a veterans pension for many years and never set foot in a VA hospital. Once a person does have access to health care benefits, I would say that is a more comprehensive package, because VA's health care system basically says, if you're eligible, we will treat you for everything, and your coverage, Veteran A's coverage, is the same as Veteran B's coverage. It's just some veterans pay differently, pay different co-pays or no co-pays at all for that care. But the health care packages are the same. The veterans' benefit packages are not the same.
Thank you. Representative Bocas?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is going to take a while.
That's good. Let's get through it.
Madam Chair, you may not be able to answer the questions, but okay. I know when I start talking here that someone's going to start writing notes back there. I know how this works. So we'll get the answers when we come down. I want to go back to the second from the last page of your presentation.
Okay.
So that we all understand the benefits of this, because when it comes down to brass tacks, we're going to be talking dollars and cents, period.
Okay.
And how do we slice this? The veterans, the pilot project that we had, was funded at, or, and I'm not sure whether it was actually funded or it was authorized, being the difference there, at $370,000, and it actually spent $300,000. Is that because there was $70,000 that was spent over at Department of Human Services, or the program only spent $300,000? Do you know that?
I I am not sure of the answer to that question. I know that Washington County and Multnomah County operate differently, and I'm not sure if I can explain the difference. One being a transfer agency and one being a contract agency. It was my understanding that Multnomah County did not receive money up front to pay the service officers needed to run the pilot project, that it fronted the people and the salaries to do so, and then once the project showed savings, they were reimbursed by seniors and people with disability. And I think that may have been because of the way the budget note was written about appropriated versus funded.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, my interest is that, you know, what happened to the other $70,000? I guess there's a compounding impact of $70,000. It's two people, and it's two more people who are working. Therefore, there's, and that's
services, right. Yeah.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sure.
Okay, so we in the first year we served 79 clients in the pilot program, and of course I understand, you know, you basically have these packets of huge stacks of paperwork, and this is how you submitted it for 79 clients, and then the net result we can see is $148,000 savings. In the second year you served 137 clients. Now is 137 more, or those packets that were really done in the first year that we actually got results in the second year? Because in the second year, you were not funded, so there wasn't any additional employees doing the work. So can you go through the 79 to 37 and the savings again for the committee, if you would, so we understand what you did the first year that caused this, that resulted in the net savings in the next year, and are we talking about the same 137, so on and so forth? Because what we're trying to do is establish a funding base here. If we put money into this through County Veteran Services, we're going to see some extraordinary benefits out the other side.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, that's a very good question, and I'm sorry that's not clear. We actually served more than 79 clients in the first year. The population that we served was more than 300 clients. 79 clients were the individuals who actually received awards from the Department of Veterans Affairs and whose veterans benefits showed a reduction in cost to the state. The numbers for the second year are cumulative. Those are not in addition. Those include the first 79 clients from year one.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, so roughly 50% of the you serve 300 vets, roughly. 50% of those, a little over 50%, which is a little under, I guess 137 clients, about 40%. I didn't bring my calculator. This wasn't revenue, so I'm normally here feverishly going away, and Representative Berger is having a heart attack over there thinking, God, he's going to ask questions forever. But the 137 that were, if we do a simple divisible, we see that the reduction in actual costs would be $1 million. I mean, there's a tremendous amount if we put the manpower or the personnel power, I stand corrected, personnel power behind this. What we see is the dollar per veteran rising. This is what a pet peeve of yours, Madam Chair.
Yes, absolutely.
Is we see the dollar per person rising. And so I see that. Now, I guess the follow-on question to that is, of the $300,000 that was spent, how many additional people were hired? And in your county, how many additional were hired, and how many are hired today? And my follow-on question that you're not going to have a clue to answer, but somebody will have, and that is by county, how many existing veteran service officers exist, and how are they funded? Now, so I think the only one you're going to be able to answer is tell us how we spent the $300,000 and where are we today? Are you the lone veteran service officer, or is there still two or three out there, or how did this exactly transpire? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Barnhart. Representative Boquist, I am the lone surviving pilot project county veteran service officer. I believe that $300,000 accounted for five staff members, two in my county and three in Multnomah County. How they're funded, I can tell you that most counties have general fund money. Some counties have Medicaid money, and counties also receive that $10,100 from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. There may be other smaller funding sources that other counties receive. I know some counties contract with their local mental health operations, county public health, but the funding is pretty much absorbed by the county general funds in most counties.
Well, Madam Chair, this is, I guess this question is very subjective, so if you want to say you're not going to represent the counties and just kind of answer as a personal question, okay, that's fine. But if we, when we come to a resolution of some sort of funding for the county veteran service officers, the first fear anyone in government would have, especially in the legislature, is if we fund your county at, we'll just take a guess, we'll just say $50,000, that the first thing the county may in fact do, and we've never heard from the Association of Oregon Counties here,
that's right,
and we're talking about giving them $5 million.
I know.
Many counties are going to look at this and say, great, here's the $50,000, and here's the money for Debbie, and take her money away and spend it somewhere else, and we'll have not gained a single inch. When in fact, what we're trying to do, and this is subjective here, what we're looking at, I think, is well beyond. We're saying the one person every federal, state, agency known to man, people, women, whatever, has said is, the county veteran service officer is the entry point. And frankly, unfortunately, for even because you don't deal with it, TRICARE and TriWest, they aren't even told when a unit is mobilized and deployed. So likely person in Bend or Redmond that knows first off that they're being deployed is the county veteran service officer, who would at least at a minimum we would envision pick up the phone, call TriWest off of their little sheet of things and say the 39 unit from whatever city is being deployed, and we really need to have you call their unit and set up a time during their mobilization process and come down. And so we're literally, when we're saying we were talking about funding county veteran service officers, we're talking about expanding their present duties. And the problem comes back very first is if we put money in this, does the county take the money out? We gain absolutely nothing. And the second thing is the county veteran service officers, how do you feel about us just dropping another, 10 inches of paperwork on you? Because I think one of the key things is going to be this TriWest, not just serving only veterans, but those that we know are going to become veterans 180 days later.
I'm not sure if I have an answer to your second question, but as far as the first question, it is our hope that the legislation that's out there now will have built into it sureties that will guarantee that the counties don't pull away their funding, that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't pull away its funding, and that any money that the Oregon legislature decides to give to us to assist veterans is in addition to the monies that we already have. You asked me about county veteran service officers and population. 34 counties have a county veteran service officers. Most counties have one. Some counties have two. My county is the largest county in the state with three service officers. We have the second largest veterans population, but I don't think there's a county out there who is adequately staffed to meet the demand of the current veteran population and the potential client base based upon that veterans population, i.e. the dependents. There could be several dependents for every veteran out there that we are also here to serve.
Last follow-up, Senator. I know you can't answer this question, but I think your association, it would be very helpful if we got a matrix of from the association, the County Veteran Services Association, that would show us who's out there, and I suppose by name is fine or however you have it, and the funding stream presently. And the reason I mention this is this: in order for the point when we come to discussion of county veterans funding county veteran service officers, we need to look at the revenue stream to figure out what safeguards are implemented. And I'm just, this is totally hypothetical, saying that you know by position, and when I say not just county, if we have by three in one county, we need to know that up front. But then in addition, what we're looking at is saying, if we know the county's funding 85% of it now, on average, or we can look at this and say, all right, we're going to put this program in place. However, the counties have to match this with 25%. We're not saying it would not be a new mandate. We'd probably, I would assume, look at the lowest common denominator or tier it or do something so that we're going in to assist the process, not assume responsibility for it and then watch it fail in front of us. And I think really the only entity that can do that is the association, because you're the only one that has contact across the boards. I would assume that at some point, Madam Chair, that the Oregon, in Associated Oregon Counties, is going to want to enter this discussion. We just had them in revenue on a very small topic yesterday, and all over the place.
I would think they would be so...
we're talking about handing a cash check here to these people.
So excited about coming here. I would bet the next meeting, Representative Boquist, it'll be filled with county commissioners and the association, and they'll be absolutely thrilled, and hopefully the county service veteran officers. Representative Kopp.
Chairman Nelson, I want to just concur with what Representative Boquist is saying. Good fiscal management would have this spreadsheet, county by county, identifying the positions, what that position, just a slight terminology, what that position does, you know, whether it's, you know, direct front contact, you know, as people come in the door, or, you know, case service provider and that sort of thing, because that would really help us see where the holes are in the system. And, you know, what you're able to do in your county obviously is not being done in many counties, and we do want to have some equity there.
Yes, good point. Ms. Kincaid, it's been my understanding, and I just think, you know, you've done an incredible job. And you've basically, you know, paved your way yourself. You know, what's needed is what you've done, which mm-hmm. is wonderful. Is there a need for us to define the responsibilities? I understand, for example, there are some county service officers who feel their primary responsibility is transportation, for example, of veterans, which is wonderful, to the hospital or elsewhere. While others say if somebody in that county does not become, you know, an encyclopedia on benefits and how to get through this maze, you know, the veteran loses, and his family or widow or spouse. So do we have a defined list of responsibilities? And then with that, like Representative Kopp said, you know, performance measurement of some sort, essential now, you know, when we get money from the legislature, they require those things.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, we don't have that. As I indicated, we're each employed by 34 different employers. So,
could you ask the association if they would possibly, you know, survey all the members and possibly just get us a good rough draft of what you see are the responsibilities, and then how they could be measured?
Okay,
we'd be grateful.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yep, Madam Chair. I have one cop just to add, if you would, Madam Chair, to the emphasis of what Representative Kopp and I said. If we identify by county what's there, I think I would remind and ask Debbie to remind her associates in the Veterans Association that when you identify by county, you also identify by vote count, which will take to get this thing passed. And so we can look out there and say, do you know in the county you represent, this is what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, I'm not a professional politician yet, right? And, but I know there are lobbyists here that fully understand how that works.
Now, Representative Boquist. You know, here's what is just unbelievable to me. You know, if we took the 370,000 veterans we have here at the end of this year, you know, and divided among you 34 people, you know, that's over 10,000 just... I'm not just, but of veterans only whom you serve. Now, just using four to a family, I mean, look at that. I mean, that's 40,000 clients. I don't know any organization in this state that has been charged with the responsibility to look after individually, have members look after 40,000 individuals and meet their needs. And so I just feel the state, the governor, the legislature, we have been so remiss in appropriately funding your positions, and I don't know why, but I do know it's a disgrace, and it's wrong. And it's incredible to me. We have almost as many veterans as we do school children. You know, 500,000 to 370,000. Look how many people were here the other day, you know, campaigning on behalf of school kids. I've never seen that on behalf of the veterans. The truth is we shouldn't have to have that. It should be done automatically and be a top priority. We always seem to forget until the time of need that safety is our top priority of our people. So I thank you for all you do. Any other questions of Ms. Kiki?
Great presentation.
Great presentation.
Yes, awesome. And we look forward to having you come back and visit with us. The one thing I just wanted to ask you is, do you know of any cases where a veteran who has been on Medicaid has been moved out of Medicaid services, which makes him or her vulnerable to being placed anywhere else in the state rather than close to their family because they've been moved off of Medicaid to the veteran benefits? That is a worry.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I understand your question.
If an individual has gone to a home in Roseburg because it's near his family, he's accessed Medicaid. Here's my question. Is the reason this is happening because the veterans program is so slow and cumbersome? But anyway, this gets this veteran in there for care. And the worry is when you put him then back on full VA benefits that, you know, he could be moved from that facility because they, you know, don't accept those payments, but they will accept Medicaid.
Madam Chair, the Department of Veterans Affairs, unlike Medicaid, does not pay the care facility directly, except in certain circumstances. For veterans receiving a VA pension, they receive that cash benefit, and then they use that cash benefit to pay for their long-term care services. So if the person's already on Medicaid in a care facility and we assist them in getting veterans benefits, a couple of things could happen. Either they could end up paying a greater portion of their care costs, reducing Medicaid's costs, but stay in the same care facility, or they could receive enough VA pension benefits to enable them to move off Medicaid but remain in that same facility. Moving off Medicaid is often a greater concern for persons who are married, who have estates, than are for persons who do not have those. But a person is not found ineligible for Medicaid because of their VA benefits. Most often those benefits are called aid in attendance, and that is a special benefit treated somewhat sacred under Medicaid regulations because it ignores that amount of aid in attendance benefits when determining whether the person's eligible, whether they're over or under the Medicaid income limit. So it's invisible in the eligibility determination. But when it comes time to determining what the veteran's cost share is for their care, that amount is thrown back in there and it's utilized to pay for that person's care. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I guess there are some concerns about the way that's handled. And I think it's the one I've seen the individual. This is where you see, you know, that hair bristle, you know, on the neck because the thought of, you know, doing anything than securing the future of that veteran where he needs to be close to his family or his spouse or, or whomever, grandchildren. To move them just seems like the most deplorable, you know, thing to do. So that's the one thing I think that makes some individuals hesitant to go after veteran benefits. One, probably because it's so long and cumbersome, you know, in time-wise to get it.
I think and perhaps, you know, maybe your question is promulgated by knowledge of the VA healthcare system that says if a veteran is 70% or more service-connected disabled, and that individual needs nursing care, that VA will pay for that nursing care in a facility. That's different than this VA pension benefit. It's above and beyond this pension benefit. VA does not contract with every nursing home in the state.
That's what I understand.
So if a veteran who is in a community-based care facility or a nursing facility and is on Medicaid and he is eligible for that VA benefit of paid nursing care, VA could only pay for that care in a nursing facility that it contracts with.
That is something we need to work on.
And I don't know what the steps are to add another nursing facility to that contract list. That's run through the VA Health Administration. There are contract social workers, contract nursing home social workers at the hospital who deal with the veterans in those categories.
How often do you talk with the Department of Veteran Affairs here?
With the State of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs? We actually deal with their Portland office on a daily basis. They are invaluable to us because they are located in the regional office where the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs is, and they are our contact with Veterans Administration employees in resolving issues that may come up. You know, when there's stalls and snags in a claims process, we go to them for help in resolving those issues.
Are they responsive?
Very.
We had testimony our last meeting that we needed an 800 number, need to be advertised. We need somebody to be, you know, responsive. How do you handle that?
I think for people in outlying areas, you know, we're fortunate in Washington County to be so near what's going on, and we find access to information quite easy. I think and I'm not sure if the complaint was about not being able to access the State of Oregon Veteran Service Officers. Okay. And I think, I don't believe they have a toll-free number for general clientele. They have a toll-free number for persons like myself, County Veteran Service Officers, to access them. I think the hope is that the veteran will deal with their local county veteran service officer as an advocate, as a representative, who will then work with the appropriate personnel in the regional office, including staff of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, to accomplish what needs to be done for that veteran.
Why do we have individuals like wives of disabled men standing on a street for a year in Eugene with a cup trying to save the home? Why does stuff like this happen? Just beyond me. Where would a person like that have gone for help? Where do these veterans go for bridge money, you know, when the tough times hit?
And it's not there. Unfortunately, there's always people who are going to fall through the cracks, if you will. This program that I'm talking about, this disability pension program, is only available to wartime veterans. So the people that were between Korea and Vietnam, between World War II and Korea, post-Vietnam, you know, they find themselves in hardship situations, and they don't have the same resources that wartime veterans do.
Would your association just tell us what we should do in those cases? We don't know. I mean, we want to be inclusive. With our statewide vet net that we're so sponsored, I hope you know Diane Salenti from my county.
Mm-hmm.
You know, term came from her. It's just so, so important to us that we get everybody in the state involved. Because everything they do is, you know, should be of appreciation to these men and women who, you know, have secured our future. So we want the chambers of commerce, the businessmen, the churches, the schools, the, you know, family coordinators, the agencies, all to come together in every one of these communities to say, you know, our veterans are critically in need. What can we do? How can we be there? And we have the 162nd coming home, you know, here in March.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's 830 more servicemen and women, and beyond the 50 who've already returned. So, but out of those, you know, we have these people, 200 amputees and 30 blinded. I mean, these are going to be critical, critical issues. We have needs to help transition these families, you know, when we have the breadwinner back home and, you know, the line of authority and the family changes, the children need counseling. Then we have these, you know, there's nobody that, as you know, goes to war mm-hmm. without some, being changed. So we want to be sure that these medical professionals, the not only the VA department and the Guard, whom we know will be there, but, you know, this entire network is there for them to reach out to help them. And I'm worried that we don't have bridge money. They're individuals who are unemployed. And they're coming home. They have 1 week to 3 weeks to be employed. And I don't see a huge list coming from the employment department that says, you know, here's our list. I think these individuals would make excellent county service veteran officers. You know, they've been there, done that. They know. So we ought to be sure they're on our list, providing we can get some money to finance it, but the program. But, you know, how we can make this vet net so comprehensive. I know if we had a military base in Oregon, like the state of Washington, it would make a difference. Since we don't, depending on the veterans to talk to one another about benefits. For example, the 3670th that just left. I mean, even our Guard itself did not know of the new program where these men and women could have gotten benefits 90 days before they left. Number one, they didn't get their orders 90 days before. So, you know, we're behind the curve on communicating. So we're really, really concerned about all these issues. So what I'd love for your association to do is to ask, you know, let's do the responsibilities, the performance measurements, the fiscal accountability that Representative Comp, Representative Boquist asked. But let's ask ourselves, how can we secure a vet net for this state that doesn't disappear when we leave Iraq? I mean, it's here forever mm-hmm. for these individuals. I mean, most of them, you know, return to help when, you know, when it's needed. I noticed yesterday with the fires starting, I thought, my goodness, these men are just going to get home and they're going to be fighting fires. They're not even going to have time to, you know, mm-hmm. transition. So, big problems, and I think the state has been greatly remiss in doing what we should do for our veterans and our military. Do you work well with the Guard? Or do you work at all with the Guard?
We have infrequent contact with the Guard. We work together with the Oregon Employment Office over the last several years to present some job fairs, if you will, and that was done in coordination with the Guard, but we really don't have that much contact with them either.
But shouldn't you now? Since all these men and women were called up under Title 10, mm-hmm. I mean, it's my understanding from our testimony on Tuesday with Dr. Berger that we're all the same, you know, we're on the same benefits. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could hear what y'all are going to be doing to work more closely with our National Guard and their members and families. And your meeting is here in April, I understand. Could we be a part of your meeting at some time?
We would love to have you be a part of our meeting.
Thank you. And we appreciate it. And I think we learn an awful lot. We want to continue to learn. What I'm really concerned about, our ombudsman being there. You know, in my personal opinion, 50 is not enough to handle 1,400,000 people who need help. Mm-hmm. But it's better than what we have now. And $10,000 can't begin to fund a position, and it's just ridiculous. Maybe we shouldn't call these county service veteran officers. Maybe we should just call them, you know, vet net officers and get over this. Who do they answer to, the county or the mm-hmm. the state? They answer to the veterans, you know, on demand, mm-hmm. on need. So maybe that would help us. But we are concerned about your program, and we're concerned about having bridging money. So where your organization sees the need for bridge money for these families is critical as we develop our plans further for legislation, for, you know, and the budget. I feel that this legislature is committed to our veterans, so I don't want to miss this opportunity to do what we should have been doing for years and years and years and years. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And next we have Ed Winkler. Please come forward.
Madam Chair.
You wore my favorite color.
Is that right?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, good. I get a lot of compliments on this shirt.
We like it.
That's because they're all Beaver fans.
Yeah, Debbie.
Well, committee
please
members.
Please identify yourself.
Okay. My name is Ed Winkler. I am currently a member of the Oregon National Guard, recent returnee from the Middle East. And I was asked to testify here on some of my experiences upon returning and some of the experiences I saw as a soldier over in the Middle East, which may be of use to you as you move forward in your planning and considerations. There's 6 points that I want to make. Talk about our training, some medical issues that we saw overseas, promotions, replacements of soldiers, equipment that we had on hand, and line of duty injuries. Regarding the training, I intend for my remarks to be rather short and succinct and brief, which can be expanded upon by your questions if you feel so appropriate. I believe that the training for the infantry, and I'm an infantryman, was the right kind of training over the past decade. Upon arriving in theater, working in a SASO, or Stabilization and Security Operation, we discovered very quickly that the kind of training that we had been conducting didn't fit the operations over there. So we did that very quickly, and I found that Oregon Guardsmen in particular, because that's the only experience I had, very quickly adapted to that. And I'm speaking particularly to the security operations we did, force protection in Kuwait, and the combat operations we did in just south of Baghdad. And I can address those issues in more detail with you on where I see the training, some key points of training, if the questions arise. Medical issues. I saw a disparity between the treatment of guardsmen over there and active duty soldiers, particularly in the arena of dental care. Two of my soldiers were denied dental care in Baghdad and Kuwait because they were not active duty. And I felt that that was inappropriate. For an active duty soldier who happens to be in a guard status to be denied certain coverages based on their needs. I had a cavity that needed to be filled. I was told that it didn't need to be filled. The reason I know that is because when I was home on leave, I went to my dentist and he said, "Oh, you have a cavity. Can I fill that for you now?" And I said, "Well, I can get it filled for free overseas." That was not the case. So that cavity will be filled in a month. Promotions. The current promotion policy for active duty and reserves is that if a soldier meets the promotion requirements, they're eligible for promotion, they are promoted and then found a position to serve in at their current level. In the National Guard, and my understanding is that there's a hard look at making this change, but they require a unit level vacancy before they will promote an individual. An individual must be qualified, meet the eligibility, and then there must be a vacant position for them to move into, and then they're promoted. And that is not the case for National Guardsmen. So we had a variety of soldiers who were qualified for promotion, enlisted, mostly among the non-commissioned officers and the officers. The enlisted people, they took their promotions within the unit. But many promotions were overlooked. And that is significant to a deployed soldier because a promotion means more money for their family at home, means more housing benefits. More separate, pay. So those are significant issues for soldiers regarding promotions. When a soldier is injured, has a medical condition or a family condition at home, and they must leave theater, there is no current mechanism for the National Guard to request a replacement, a single soldier replacement. Active duty and reserve forces, they have that system in place. They just request the fill. They receive that fill as the personnel become available, but in the Guard, it's a different story. The 2nd Battalion, who's returning now, while I was over there, the current brigade commander came and visited with us, and we addressed that issue with him as a battalion in a large body. And he said that the way that they're working around that, and I believe they've done a great job with the 2nd Battalion, is that because that system isn't in place, they had two replacement pools that they had set aside. And it seems like it was 6 months into the rotation they planned to inject a certain number of personnel into it. And so that is a local level fix that I believe the Oregon National Guard did a great job on to shore up the shortages of soldiers, because people will have family issues. There will be medical issues that preclude soldiers from continuing their current assignment. And the one thing that doesn't change over there is the mission requirement. Every soldier counts.
Sure.
And when a squad of 9 infantrymen has a single soldier pulled from its ranks for whatever reason, it affects that squad's ability to conduct its mission. Soldiers get a little less sleep, they work a little harder, so every soldier counts. And so one recommendation I have is that that the Guard look closely at the single soldier replacement for at the National Guard level. I want to speak about equipment. We deployed into Kuwait with all of the equipment that we needed except for small arms protective inserts for the interceptor body armor. However, we deployed into Kuwait, and there was no requirement for any soldier in Kuwait to wear the SAPI plates, the small arms protective inserts, at the time that we deployed there. However, we conducted several missions across the Iraqi border, including the 91-day combat ops. And at no time were we ever allowed to cross that border without those protective inserts. So the inserts were made available to units who needed to cross the border. When we returned from our 91-day combat ops, we kept our SAPI plates and used them as part of the personal protection for the security operations we conducted in Kuwait. I will say that, you know, in the time that I was in Kuwait, I can think of only a couple of instances where there may have been some shootings on the roads, particularly on the day Saddam was captured. Kuwait was a relatively safe place to be. And so the need for small arms protective inserts is a must, even in a relatively safe place, because it is a rear area. But it is certainly more critical for the forward area, which is why soldiers were not allowed to cross the border without that equipment. So I can't speak for the 2nd Battalion, but I believe that because they were attached to the 1st Cavalry Division, an active duty division, that they probably did not leave this country without those small arms protective inserts. So so there's been a lot of questions about whether soldiers are adequately equipped. And aside from up-armored Humvees, we had all of the equipment we needed. We were better equipped in many cases in active duty units. We had all of the high-tech infantry equipment from the night vision goggles, the latest night vision goggles, the PAC-4 aiming device, which is quite simply a phenomenal piece of equipment that mounts on a weapon. You activate the laser, and you can only see it through your night vision device. The M68 aim point, which is another phenomenal piece of equipment for daytime. It's an M68 aim point, which is a tremendous piece of equipment for close quarter combat, which quite simply is, it's a scope. When you look through the scope, you see a red dot. That red dot does not appear anywhere, day or night. You only see it when you look through the scope. This is equipment that we deployed with. We deployed with the M4 carbine, which is the collapsible buttstock. It's got an increased effective range. It's easier to use in close quarter combat. We've had that equipment. We didn't get that equipment when we deployed. We had that equipment and trained with it since I took command in the year 2000 of the unit I deployed with.
That is so good to hear.
Well, just reporting it like it is, ma'am.
Appreciate hearing it.
The last point that I'd like to make is line of duty injuries. A line of duty injury is any type of injury that's incurred in the line of duty. It could be anything from a twisted knee when you tripped over the tent peg going to the latrine, to falling off of the back of a Humvee because the driver goosed it, and because there was a potential combat situation that needed to be addressed and you rolled off the back and sprained your wrist, or whatever the case may be. My observation was that soldiers coming off of active duty are falling through the cracks in terms of line of duty injuries. I could speak with some authority about that because I was one of a handful of my soldiers in my company that filed a line of duty injury, and mine was simply for plantar fasciitis from being on my feet for 14 months. You know, just constantly on my, I'm a light infantryman. You know, it's not like we have a lot of vehicles that we can deal with. I got a rucksack and a rifle. When we returned, we were intended to come through Fort Carson but got diverted to Fort Lewis. At no time was there any guidance that was received that we should, those who had line of duty injuries, should remain on TRICARE Prime, which would then cover all of the medical treatments without any deductibles or copays. And so all of us who fell into that category came back. We refratted, which is return from active duty. We refratted accordingly. But I also want to point out that those of us who had line of duty injuries had to go see a medical professional because of that line of duty injury. And a soldier has an option to stay on active duty until they are medically stabilized. However, we were told more than once that we were encouraged not to do that and get the medical care at home. It freed up the system. It also freed up dollars, obviously, because if a soldier is on active duty, they don't get paid. Okay, so they believe that there's a system out there for covering the line of duty injuries, and if a soldier wants to return home, and I tell you, every one of us wanted to. We didn't want to stay at Fort Lewis. We didn't want to stay at Fort Carson away from our families. We've been gone long enough already. That we all said, Roger, we'll take that line of duty injury home, and we'll have it treated by a civilian professional. Well, as my medical bills began to stack up, I realized that TRICARE and my personal insurance, who should not have been responsible for paying those medical expenses, weren't paying them anyway. And so it took a lot of conversation with TRICARE before we realized that, kind of an interesting comment as I'm talking to the woman there, she says, your commander should have informed you that you should have stayed on TRICARE Prime. And my response was, I am the commander.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's exactly what I thought when she said that. You know, I am the commander, and at no time was I ever briefed by anyone in any processing or by a chain of command. Our chain of command didn't know either. They would have briefed me.
Right. That's what
they would have done
on this new program last week.
So
how do they usually communicate with you?
Who's they?
Anybody. A DOD, anybody of benefit.
Through the chain of command.
Just, I mean, do you have, I'm sorry, since I've not been in those positions, or in the military, which I wish I could have served, and I'm grateful for your service and your leadership.
You're welcome.
How do you have weekly meetings where you leaders are, you know, advised, or do you have staff who stays on these issues of what benefits are available and to tell you so you can then tell your men and women?
Generally speaking, the information went out by email because in our battalion, our companies were spread out.
Oh.
Okay? So we had one company in Saudi Arabia for five of the 14 months, and then the other two companies, one, I was in Baghdad while another company was in Ash-Shuaibah port. We were separated for 3 months, then we returned to the Kuwaiti airport. We're a little closer, but still separated. So we would get together. There was a weekly meeting, but they put out information which they received. And if they don't receive the information, they can't put it out.
So email is the
best way? It's one way when people are spread out.
Okay.
Telephones, we had telephones, cell phones over there worked, and so there was a lot of communication, but this piece of information did not get pushed down to my level or even the battalion commander's level because he would have briefed it. And so regarding the line of duty, it took me asking a lot of questions and finally finding a Sergeant Estes over at the Army Reserve Center here in Salem who said, fax me your explanation of benefits and we'll get it taken care of. And in a matter of days, providers began to get paid. My concern is that I know this now and I can communicate that to my soldiers, but regardless, my point is that in Oregon, they have figured out a way to take care of the soldier. They did a great job with me. Mm-hmm. They're not preparing soldiers adequately at the demobilization station for staying in the right kind of insurance.
Yeah.
we were in the wrong, you know, because we came into Fort Lewis, we were no longer in the correct region, and that changed things for us. It's a rather confusing set of circumstances. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this concludes my remarks, subject to your questions.
Thank you so much for being here and for this information. I'm just curious, are any of the members of the military restricted from coming forward and saying we have these issues? And because we want to hear them. We want to know, because knowledge is power, and it helps us, you know, pressure Washington, and it helps us work with our legislators here to cure some of these problems and with the governor. Do all of the members of the military feel comfortable in coming forward and speaking?
I have never been told that I could not speak about my organization. However,
I want to tell you that I think it's that is leadership, and I want to compliment you on doing so in such a nice way. So perhaps others will be helped by what you've been through.
And I would submit to you that...
And you care about your men and women.
I do. I would submit to you that... I've had a very positive experience throughout the turmoils which we've experienced, and I guess that's a choice. I'm also smart enough to know that I don't bite the hand that feeds me, and I've got no disparaging comments, even if I could think of some, to make about the organization that I belong to. It is a fine organization, without question, which I could speak, you know, on and on and pontificate forever and ever, and would be meaningless in this form.
Well, we just want you to know you sure make us all proud.
Thank you, ma'am.
Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Brood.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to say a special thank you to Captain Winkler. Captain Winkler is a constituent of mine who met this summer, and he had just recently returned and started sharing stories. And I'm particularly honored to have you here today and to share your testimony. But I do have to respectfully disagree with Madam Chair regarding the color of your shirt. I'm sure I can speak for Vice Chair Farr and myself when a couple of us bleed green and gold. It's just particularly unsightful. Sorry. And what I would like to, and you've mentioned this, you've covered this to a degree in how it was handled or not handled with the line of injury, with the line of duty injury that you received, and how it was taken care of after you were deactivated. My question is a little larger, but would entail that. What is the Give me your personal experience with the network of support that started when you're activated, specifically for your family. While you're overseas, spent 14 months overseas, how is the information there? Is it being presented? Is the access to whatever services or benefits may be needed readily available, or are there problems?
My wife reported to me on a variety of occasions that there was no time when she had a need that she wasn't able to pick up the phone and call our family support coordinator or some other representative at the armory who stayed behind, who's a full-time support. Our family support coordinator is usually a wife of a soldier who's a volunteer, who becomes educated in a variety of frequently asked questions and resources that a family would have in during a time of deployment. And my wife reported that there was no time that she didn't have the ability to get the information that she needed. And you know, she didn't have she didn't place any tremendous burden on the system. She had her own family network, community network, neighborhood. You know, I'll tell you that she didn't cook a meal for like the first 3 months I was gone. Neighbors and church members brought meals probably three times a week.
I was going to follow. Yeah, but
go ahead, Representative. Yeah.
Obviously, you have a command under you, and even though, as you've alluded to, even though you're deactivated now, you still have the men and women that I know you keep contact with that serve below you. I hope your case is not an exception, because you've done, as you and I have talked offline, you've done remarkably well and got your business back to where it was before you were deployed, and that's great. I hope we want that to be the rule, not the exception. I want to know from you, with the men and women that serve below you, is that happening? And if not, what are the problems you're seeing, if you can categorize them?
The primary problem is that, in terms of employment, is that if a business goes out of business, the soldier's not going to get reemployed at that business.
Right.
There have been a few cases of soldiers coming back where they were unable to get their job back, a small business. You know, the funding's not there, the business hasn't grown right. And I can't speak to any specifics, but I know that they're there. And, you know, in talking to one of my platoon sergeants, it took him a while, but he got employment. He's employed now. But very few that I know of that had employment issues. But I will tell you that, for the most part, most soldiers made more money deployed than they made working for their civilian employer, with the benefits, especially being tax-free.
Representative Palmer.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Ed. And I don't know your rank. Are you major now?
I am.
All right. Then I will call you Major Winkler.
No, you can call me Ed in this form.
My question for you, and maybe it's also a question for my fellow committee members, because we had some testimony on Tuesday from a mother of a returning soldier, and that returning soldier wanted to do the same thing that you did. He wanted to be with his family, so he asked to be returned home. He waived, the way she described it, his rights for coverage, military coverage, and then paid the cost of his medical treatment on his own. And I'm wondering if anyone remembers, was that Fort Lewis that he... So I'm wondering if maybe it's a problem with Fort Lewis, and that somehow we need to get the information to them to be sure that they're issuing.
I think we've just heard here from my left. It certainly is.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Boquist. I appreciate that. But I think maybe that's something that needs to be addressed. And you were fortunate that you had somebody who went to bat for you, so you were able to receive coverage.
I can't speak for the soldier, but if... One of the things that our battalion did very conscientiously was, if there was a soldier who felt they had an injury that wasn't healed, for which they wanted treatment beyond the active duty time, we filled out a line of duty investigation packet, which followed us through the processing center. And everyone who had one of those went before a medical professional who did a final evaluation. And then, again, that's where I was encouraged, you know, go home and get it treated by a civilian doctor. I believe that that was done in good faith at Fort Lewis, not knowing the insurance issues that are faced by returning reservists and guardsmen. But I can't speak to that. That's just an assumption that I'm making.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So it makes sense then that some coordination of effort goes out to the bases where soldiers are returning, so that we can be sure that they're given the correct information.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Major Winkler, I'm concerned about the ability of you commanders to be able to assess the at-risk servicemen and women who've served under you. And how do we provide for that opportunity for you to be with them? I understand there is no funding for that. So I'm greatly concerned because you probably know your men and women better than anybody. And you would be able to identify, you know, mental situations that others might not be alert to. How do you...
Well, I will tell you that...
What can we do?
Well, I will tell you that... that I sat down with every one of my soldiers in the last month in Kuwait, the last month of our mission, and I went through just a mental health checklist regarding their deployment. Things like any significant change at home, a death in the family, a divorce, financial issues at home, children, any children in treatment. Have you had any sleepless nights, irritability, nightmares? You know, is there anything going on in your life now which you believe is going to have an impact on you adversely beyond this deployment? And we those questionnaires were in each of the demobilization packets that went with them through the demobilization site. I know that, speaking personally, mine was not looked at by any medical professional or any psychological evaluation, but I can tell you that based on my interview with them, I made a recommendation whether someone needed an ongoing evaluation just because I'm not a psychiatrist. Mine was just a first cut at taking a look at what the needs of the soldiers were. But I spent a significant interview with each soldier, and I'd walk the line. You know, I'd go point to point, talk to them while they're on duty, you know, watching a gate or just sitting in a tower. And so that probably took me a couple of weeks to get that effort done. But it was...
So who do those forms go to?
They stay in the... They were in the demobilization packet. So they stay with the packet, in the soldier's packet.
And does that go to the...
Oh, internally, first it went to our battalion, and then the battalion put them in the packets. So I hope that answers your question.
And so can anyone look at them? And
well, I don't know if anyone can look at them.
Do we have someone assigned to evaluate them?
I don't know. I don't know if we do have someone assigned to look at them.
Okay.
I do know that we have people assigned to address the red flags. Okay. And I had two soldiers, I believe, that needed a follow-on question with somebody that a little more educated than myself.
I believe Representative Buffus was
ahead. Oh, go ahead.
Okay, thank y'all. Okay, let's just go.
You're a gentleman.
He is, indeed.
Major Winkler, my question for you is, do you believe that sometimes soldiers would not be comfortable admitting that they're experiencing some side effects of combat because they don't want to appear weak?
I absolutely believe that to be a true statement. However, I want to explain to you how a light infantry organization works, where men, and it's only men, okay, they live together, they work together, they play together, they talk. And they talk. And if often I would hear something from their squad leader, "Sir, we have an issue. Okay, he's taking a look at." There would be a few soldiers who would say nothing. But for the most part, you're bored over there and you talk. "I had this dream," or, "You know, I've got this twitch. You know, I need to go..." So it's a function of human nature for most people to talk. And I believe that a few soldiers may have slipped through the crack because personality or whatever, they just never revealed anything. So that is certainly a possibility.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
So what kind of treatment is available for those soldiers who may either don't admit that they've experienced combat stress at the time, or who return home and then later develop post-traumatic stress?
Because they're returning veterans, they would qualify for the Veterans Administration benefits. That is the net for them. And many people don't know that they're experiencing anything. You know, I've been almost a year home, and it wasn't until two weekends ago at Camp Rialia where we were doing some training, and I was observing the 1st Battalion doing some training, and I watched a bunch of soldiers who were training as the Quick Reaction Force jump into a Humvee mounted with a 50 caliber machine gun on it, which is exactly what we used over there. And I know that when that takes place, they're going through the wire and into harm's way. It's the first time I ever shuddered since I've been back. I thought, oh. You know, that wasn't a good feeling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was 10 months before I had my first shudder. So.
Do you ever have contact with your county veteran service officers?
I have never talked to them. Never have. They have never contacted me.
Has the Department of Veteran Affairs ever contacted you, or have you ever...
At the unit level, they contact the armory, but I don't recall having any significant conversation with them one-on-one outside of a briefing prior to us leaving, and one when we returned.
Yeah, Ed, can you give me... I guess you demobed in April of 04, right?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me when you changed command, when your XO changed command, if your XO is still there, and then it's Joe Kramer, right? When did Joe Kramer change command? And where does his XO go? I'm trying to find a chain of custody here for 18 months later when we have mental health problems. And
okay.
Obviously, you're not in command of the company anymore.
Right.
So
right.
Give me the dates and your thoughts on that.
Joe Kramer rotated out of command, I believe, very quickly after we got back. April, May time frame?
Within 30 to 60 days.
I think so. I was not in town. I believe it was late May, early June, because I was unable to be there at the change of command ceremony. The XO is BJ Prendergast, and he is just now rotating out of the Battalion 3 slot there at the battalion, and he told me he was moving into the state PAO office. Who was the other?
When did you leave, and where's your XO?
Oh, my XO is Phil Chick, Lieutenant Phil Chick. He took command of Echo Company here in Salem June time frame, July time frame, last summer, and is still in command there. And I left command officially in July, and seems like mid-July of 04.
Okay. Follow-up, Manager?
Yes.
Drill schedule? Did you get caught in the DOD where you couldn't drill for 90 days, or what was your drill schedule when you came back?
Actually, I wouldn't call it caught. It was like a benefit, if you will. We did not have to drill until September, but we could if we wanted to. And so that was an option that was placed before us, and I tell you, I chose not to drill. It was the greatest summer in 20 years.
Major Winkler, would you? I just think you're just an incredible person. I'm so impressed with you and the way you speak, and you know your business, your men. Is there one benefit that it's not the orange shirt?
I heard the orange shirt.
Is there one particular benefit, however large or small, that would be of greatest value to our Oregon military men and women? I mean, is it a hunting license? Is it $250,000 of life insurance? Is it a license plate? Is it education benefits? Is it... are there what do you think would be the best way to give them something that would really be of importance?
Madam Chair, as I look back, the best benefit that I received, in my opinion, and based on comments made by other soldiers, was a set of an American flag and a medal given by the National Guard Association, I believe, a flag in a case, a medal as a citizen soldier, a lapel pin, and a certificate commending the citizen soldier. And I display that proudly on a shelf as a collection in my living room. It is a significant memento to the service that we rendered. I will tell you that money is always a motivator, but we've got some new bonuses for enlisting soldiers now here in Oregon. I believe it's $10,000 to enlist in the Oregon Guard and $15,000 if you extend your enlistment. And according to a battalion commander I talked to last week, he said that what the bonus is doing is it's making the new recruits say, wow, because different from other bonuses that have been paid, this is a lump sum up front, where most bonuses are paid half up front and half at the midpoint, I believe, or some variation of that. This is a lump sum. And so the new recruits are saying, wow, this is great. Those who are considering reenlistment, it's causing them to stop for a second and say, huh. Because never before have I ever seen any kind of bonuses paid for people to stay in the military like they're being paid right now in the Oregon Guard. I believe it's an Oregon benefit, not a federal benefit. Maybe someone can...
It's federal.
Is it federal?
Okay. It's federal.
I understand, but it is wonderful, and I'm just glad. I appreciate that information. Well, we don't want to totally drain you, but one last question from the committee. Well, we just want to thank you so much for being here. And
you're very welcome.
Appreciate you.
I would like to say one last thing, that after 91 days of combat ops, I brought every one of my soldiers back without combat injury or death.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I think we should just stand up and recognize
you. Yeah.
And we just have Mr. Kluding, and if you come forward, please, and then we'll quickly get to our bill drafts for the day.
Madam Chair Nelson,
committee. My name, for the record, is Bill Flitting, Western Council of Industrial Workers, and I appreciate Representative Bruin. He touched on the question with all the problems that we've heard discussed. My thoughts was, how is the family coping back home? Does a conduit of information have to go clear up through over to the soldier and then back down to the family, or is the family able to get the proper treatment? And I just thought I wanted to ask the committee about that. And thank you for asking that question.
Thank you for being here. Any questions to Mr. Clutie?
No.
Okay, if not, we will close the informational meeting at this time and offer. Yes, sir.
Would you come forward? Jim Wolf.
Excuse me, sir.
Excuse me?
Did you say
he said he would like to testify?
Oh, please come forward, Mr. McDaniel.
My name is Mac McDonald, and I represent basically Oregon veterans. Some things have not been brought out this morning. At the federal building in Portland, the American Legion, the VFW, the DAV, and others each have a veteran service officer who works with veterans from their organizations and other veterans. So it's not just the 34 state veteran service officers in the state of Oregon. On claims for disability, basically, while you're on active duty in the service, if you have a claim for disability, it best be in your health record, because if it's not in your health record, you're going to have a tough time proving your claim. You have to go out and get people to testify for you if it's not in your health record. And I know that was emphasized while I was in the service. The bottom line of where I'm coming from is what's best for the veteran. They've talked about this pilot project that they had in Washington County, etc. I want to point out that if you go in and get a person that is on Medicaid, he's in a retirement home, and if he's happy, when you get veterans benefits for him, you're gambling. He may get veterans benefits that take him off Medicaid, but don't give him enough to stay in that home. Once he goes off Medicaid, he has to pay for his own medical, etc. So we're on very dangerous grounds when we go into a retirement home, get veterans benefits that don't enable him to stay there because he can't afford it, and then the veteran is the loser. So you've got to be very, very careful. If you can't get him veterans benefits that allow him to stay in that veterans home, we're doing him a disservice.
Sorry.
And I'm sure there's instances where this has happened. So I'm very, very leery of this pilot project where we go down, seek out veterans that are in the veterans home, they're happy on Medicaid, everything's paid for them. We're going to do something. We're going to get them and save the state money. I don't care if the state saves 1 cent. I would care what's best for the veteran.
Absolutely.
And we really have a problem with this pilot project. I'm really scared to death of it, that our veterans are going to be the big loser.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate you. And any questions for Mr. McDonald? We have our Honorable Director of Veteran Affairs here, and Director Willis. Should we allocate time to you this morning?
It's disrespectful to speak from the back of the room. So
it certainly is, because we don't have it on record.
Yes, and for the record, I am Jim Willis, Director of Veterans Affairs, and I was just here to see Madam Chair at the conclusion of the hearing.
Thank
but
you
I'm
for being
I'm always happy
here.
To answer questions if there are any. And
any questions of
none,
the Director?
I'll just sit down.
Oh, no, and we made no money off of him today on the acronyms. All right. Okay, now I will close the informational meeting, and we will go to our draft, and I'll call on our very competent, capable administrator to tell us what we're doing.
Madam Chair, this is the first batch of several legislative drafts that Legislative Council has put together. These 15 are described in the information numbers as with the relating to the title and also the catch line. And there are 15 of these legislative drafts. I have two packages of them if anyone wants to look at the individual drafts. What I've said with other committees that have done this, ordinarily it's a formality, but it is, does require an action on the part of the committee to introduce these as committee bills, so you're certainly welcome to, any of the members is welcome to look at the drafts and decide whether or not they are wanting to vote for it or not.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you very much. I think these look excellent, a lot of great impacts. I guess the two I would have a question about are the two that at least appear to not have, kind of be outside of our jurisdiction in terms of this committee. One would be 3197,
right,
related to motorcycle helmets, and the second would be 3404 related to PERS. Those two may be good bills. They just don't seem to be, to me anyway, to be under our jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. I might tell you about 3197. That did come from veterans, and I'm sure you know we have a huge group of motorcycle veterans that just make you proud anywhere you go. I've done auctions, and you pull into a fairground, a veterans auction, and here will be 500 motorcycles. And what I'm amazed is these men tend to get themselves where they should be for all the vet meetings, that they should be at events, and it's a truly supportive group. So I myself brought that bill in from the military, the veteran motorcycle groups. There are many of them, and so that's why it's here. What they ask in this case was that they be allowed not to have to wear their helmets if they're 18 years of age or older. For goodness sake, they can go to war when they're 18. So this was, their thought. If they they would like very much to do away with that. They also feel that it's dangerous. So isn't that interesting? But they'd be prepared to give us testimony if we'd at least hear the bill for them. And regarding 3404, Mr. Administrator, do you want to talk more about this one?
I have no additional information on 3404.
Madam Chair.
Yes, the Representative Croft.
Just for clarification, so the proposal that's out here is that these are committee bills, and all of our names would be on these bills unless we request otherwise?
They will appear, it will say, sponsored by the Committee on Veterans Affairs. Okay. It won't have any individual legislator names on it.
Well, so I hear at this time the only two that you wish to be withdrawn from that could be sponsored individually by the chair, for example, would be 3197. I'm happy to do that on behalf of our veterans. And 3404, I'll find out further where that came from and ask that individual to sponsor that bill. Are there any others?
No. Madam Chair?
Yes. Go ahead. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about 3437. It sounds like a great idea, but I wonder if it's unconstitutional.
Thank you for asking that question. I am happy to speak to that issue because I just think it's unbelievable that we can put decals on public vehicles that says, I love the Department of, Economic Development or Department of Transportation, but we cannot say, put a decal on a public vehicle that says, I support our troops, or the yellow ribbon says support our troops. And that's where that came from.
Well, Madam Chair, my understanding is from an incident in Eugene at the University of Oregon. You probably know about that. It was in the news.
Yes, I do know that.
President Frohnmayer determined that no stickers or decals of any kind were allowed on state vehicles. And so that's why I wonder if it's unconstitutional, because if we allow some drivers to put anything on a state-owned vehicle, then other drivers who want to support different things, such as in a political race, could say,
you know, I feel strongly about this, and if this group of people are allowed to display stickers, then I should be allowed to as well. That was my question about the unconstitutionality of it.
Let me go to our good administrator, who knows far more than I do about anything.
These are, Madam Chair, these are legislative drafts. I just think the merits of these things probably more appropriate to argue them after they're printed in bills. And this one might be, any of these might be referred to this committee or might not. Most of them have to do with veterans, so I'm assuming they would be referred to this committee. And ordinarily, that's the reason you have a public hearing and invite anybody to come and comment and on that. When legislative council writes these things up, they ordinarily, if they believe that it's unconstitutional, they will so indicate to the requester, and we have no information along those lines on this particular one. That in reading this, it does seem to be quite restricted. If you look at 3437, it does talk about when the nation is at war, and specifically what the wording can be, and a little bit more about the details of the particular sign. So I think that whoever was writing this was conscious of it. And these are drafts that would come to you. That's why I put down the relating to clause, because you can see state-owned motor vehicles. This could be used as a vehicle for something completely different. The specifics could be changed. There's a lot of things that could happen to it. What we're talking about is just whether or not we want to have the bill, have it introduced as a bill and print it up and put into the stack of several thousand bills that the legislature will be considering.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Any other questions? Okay. If not, I will ask our good administrator and his able assistant, who make us look so good every week, to continue to process these bills so that we may have immediate work sessions, public hearings and work sessions on them, hopefully next week.
Madam Chair, you have a big responsibility in this. If these are approved by the committee, you'll need to initial sign them so that we can drop them at the desk, and then it'll be 3 or 4 days before they're printed and then first read, and then they'll be at the Speaker's office for possible referral.
Thank you, and I'll make myself available, except you have sent me to the Dalles tomorrow, and I'm looking very forward to seeing our home, veterans home in the Dalles, and also looking at the economic condition of that county, who somehow got Google to come there instead of our getting it from my Yamhill County.
You'll need a motion to accept these if you want to have them introduced.
Okay. Could I please, at this time, have a motion to accept these measures? Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move that the LCs, with the exception of 3197 and 3404, is that not correct, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Be brought forth as committee bills.
Okay, is there any objection?
Madam Chair, would you mind if I just read the ones that are remaining just by numbers?
Yes, please
for
do.
The record?
Yes.
These are the LC numbers 1911, 2038, 2039, 3021, 3042, 3396, 3399, 3400, 3401, 3430, 3433, 3437, and 3439.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any objection? If not, we will proceed, and the motion is passed. Is there any other discussion? I might just ask the members to please review the press release you were given this week. We'd like to get it out tomorrow with your corrections. We really want to broadcast statewide all media our VetNet program. And we'll appreciate getting your comments back on that. Also, hopefully today we will be scheduling our first meeting out of this committee room. And I will let you know as soon as we find out when that can be set up with the Oregon Guard.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, yes, sir.
I wanted to mention also you have a special meeting set for 3:45 on Monday. For the possible consideration of additional legislative drafts that would come in. We do not yet have a an agenda for Tuesday, but be looking for that. And then Thursday, we have the TRICARE medical people coming in next week to talk. And I did want to mention also that Mac McDonald has arranged for you to get a copy of the Veterans Affairs Department newsletter, which comes out every 2 months. If you fill out the little form that is with it there, my responsibility is to collect those forms that have been filled out, and I'm going to give them to Mac.
And I want to thank him. We're so glad to have this. I want to thank the director for producing this.
Yes, Representative Call. Just a comment. After TriWest was here, they told us how easy it was to access the providers and such. And I was hoping, I was going to ask if Jim had heard information from them, because I went to their website and I tried several tactical maneuvers on that website to find out the providers for our local region, was unsuccessful. And so I hope that maybe if they're coming again, maybe they can show us how to use the website even, or if they've given us those lists that we require.
Is this the list of participating dentists?
It was just, I wanted to know what health care providers were in our local region.
Dentist,
we got the dentist, but we didn't get the others.
Oh, my office dentist, which we can,
okay,
provide to you.
But it would be really helpful if we had a little bit of a presentation how to even maneuver their website. And if that's not essential, but it wasn't as easy as I thought.
We've also asked staff, Paul Brown and her staff at the Veteran Affairs, to, you know, help us know how to tell others. I'm not talking about professionals, but I'm talking about legislators and Chamber of Commerce directors, how we access information for our veterans. So I believe we're going to get that shortly.
Right.
And also, it was recommended to us by the chair of the Department of Human Services that we invite Bill Olson of the Brain Injury Association to testify for us. This is about brain injury in the war in Iraq, and so we will be inviting him in. Yes.
Someone from the Brain Injury Association stopped by my office yesterday because I had requested some information, and she indicated that 40 Oregonians with brain injuries, traumatic brain injuries, were returning within the next 2 months. Is that correct information?
Probably.
So I suggested that she contact you to see if she could give a presentation.
Yes, good. And are there any other issues?
Madam Chair, we're going to meet Monday at 3:45. The bill submission date has been moved 7 days, has it not?
Yes, it has. But
The technical answer to that is that they intend to, by motion on the floor, Monday. So your chair may have an announcement to make following that motion, but I wouldn't want to cancel that meeting until that motion passes.
Okay. I understand.
Also, I want to thank the members who were at the Senate hearing, and it is very important, and thanks to our being there, the good chair, Chairman Shields of the Senate, has agreed to work with our amendments, and we'll move forward, and hopefully those bills will be here very quickly. It's certainly our plan to get that first large bill out before the 162nd gets out. So I appreciate the Senate support and the veterans. Thank you so much, and we are adjourned. I'll close this work session.